Accession number 1898, Reel 2.
Commander Turner, Reel 2.
We had about 50 officers in the wardroom for the night. We entertained them with whiskey, bacon and eggs, and the like, and they thought it was the Ritz after the hardships they had endured. The ship's company had something like 240 guests on the mess decks. They also entertained them with food, cigarettes, etc. And interestingly, when later on asked to put in the bill for it, they refused. I would like to say something about the high morale of these merchant ships, officers and men. They had had a very tough time indeed. Most of them had been on board the Altmark for something like 3 months. After the sinking of the Graf Spee, the Altmark had gone down into Antarctic waters for some weeks, and she had then worked her way up the American coast across to Iceland and the north of Norway. And one must congratulate Captain Dow on his skill in avoiding all the British patrols. The prisoners had done everything in their power to let their fate be known. They had dropped bottles over the side, and in Norwegian waters, when the Norwegians had boarded the ship to examine it, the prisoners who had been kept out of sight down below made a horrific noise to try to attract attention, which the Altmark had tried to cover by working its winches and other engines. Despite all their hardships, the prisoners were really in great form and a great credit to the merchant service.
Can you tell me something about Captain Vian, what kind of a man he was?
Captain Vian, to my mind, was the best tactical admiral we had. I say admiral because about 18 months after the Altmark episode, he was promoted to Rear Admiral. I served with him in Cossack for about 2 months. He was a very tough captain. But I learnt that you had to stand up to him if you were to earn his respect. Shall we say that in 10 times when he ticked me off, I always said, in 10 times when he ticked me off, he was probably right in 6, and I said, aye, aye, sir, and carried on. In 3, the issue was doubtful, and I said, aye, aye, sir, and I carried on. But in the 10th, you knew he was wrong, and you stood up to him and argued the case, and he respected you. I have the greatest admiration for Captain Vian. He was a difficult captain, but he was absolutely just. He earned 3 DSOs in the Cossack, one for the Altmark, one for an operation off the Norwegian coast, and the 3rd in the sinking of the Bismarck, in which he was commanding the destroyers. After his promotion to Rear Admiral, he had a very distinguished career, including the evacuation of Greenland, running a convoy from Alexandria to Malta, and bluffing his way past the Italian fleet, for which he was knighted. He was in command of the British naval forces in the invasion of Normandy, coming, of course, under the supreme command of Admiral Ramsay, and finally out in the Pacific, he was commanding one of our aircraft carrier squadrons. As you probably know, after the war, he had several distinguished jobs and was ultimately made an admiral of the fleet.
Was he popular with the crew, the Cossack, do you know?
It's difficult to say whether a captain is popular or not. What I will say is he was very much respected, and I think they would have followed him anywhere.
Were you with the Cossack during the battles off Narvik?
No. I left the Cossack, being relieved by the then Lieutenant Commander Gretton, the day before the Norwegians were invaded. So Gretton was the first lieutenant in the Second Battle of Narvik. Gretton, you may remember, was subsequently a great anti-submarine ace commanding convoy escorts, and he finished up as a vice admiral.
Can you tell me the kind of work that you took up at the Admiralty afterwards with signals?
Yes, when I was relieved from Cossack, I joined the signal school at Portsmouth and taught wireless to the then signal officer's course. That took about 3 months. Then I was employed in various signal jobs in the Portsmouth area and also in establishing communications between army units and naval headquarters in various parts of England. I was sent up to the Admiralty to relieve an officer urgently needed at sea in August of 1940. I became an armchair warrior. I was told that I would be there a few weeks. In fact, I stayed 4 1/4 years. I had a fascinating job. I was part of a small team which kept the Naval Wireless Organization all around the world in good order. And in that role, I spent every third night in the Admiralty to deal with any emergencies. I was also appointed at an early stage to establish communications liaison with the United States Navy. And in October 1940, I started work with Lieutenant MacDonald, later captain of the US Navy, in producing some sort of joint communications which could be used between the British and United States fleets in the event that the United States came into the war. This was, of course, very secret at the time, but it showed great foresight on the parts of the heads of both navies. I think probably the most important thing we did was to establish the principle that if a force of one fleet joined up with a force of the other, they would normally adopt the complete communication system of the host fleet, and liaison groups would be provided to make it work satisfactorily. This principle remained throughout the war. In spring of 1942, when the Americans sent a squadron over to assist the home fleet, they adopted the British communications system. In the latter part of the war, when we sent large forces to the Pacific, the British forces adopted the United States system. We also foresaw that there might be occasions when, in common pursuit of the enemy, squadrons from the two fleets might come together when there would be no opportunity to exchange liaison forces. And for this purpose, we established certain signal books and a code of flags and various other procedures which could be used in such circumstances to at least exchange tactical signals. These books were made up in secret packages, distributed to both navies, but with strict orders that the package was not to be opened until ordered. In fact, I do not think they were ever used, but the precaution was there. This liaison with the U.S. Navy continued throughout my time in the Admiralty, and of course became less and less secret, and other services were also brought in on it. It was a fascinating experience, and I cannot speak too highly of the United States communication officers who worked with me at various times. Arising out of this, quite accidentally, I was on duty in the Admiralty on the night of Pearl Harbor. With a difference in time zones, the news of the attack reached the Admiralty at about 9:01 at night. The duty signal officer in the war room rang me up in my office. I went down, and at round about 9:30, a signal was brought to us to go out as an Admiralty A message. That means to all units and commands of the Royal Navy all over the world. It was most immediate and in plain language, and it read, "Commence hostilities against Japan." It was signed by a top civil servant, and underneath was typed, "Approved by First Lord, approved by Prime Minister." I took the message along to our wireless room, stopped all traffic, had it transmitted on every circuit throughout the world. I then rang up my colleague in the U.S. liaison group and said, "You remember Churchill said, within the hour we'll be at war if you are attacked?" I said, 45 minutes.
Now, you were at the Admiralty during the London Blitz.
Yes.
Can you tell me what you remember of the start of that?
Yes, I had been in the Admiralty a very short time when the 1940 Blitz opened. My experiences at the start were very much the same as other people's. But I was sleeping in the cellars of the Admiralty on the night that the Admiralty got Blitz in 1941. But was not hurt. Fortunately, that night had been a very heavy blitz, and all the people in the upper offices, except for fire watchers, had been brought down into the lower parts of the Admiralty. We suffered from time to time with our wireless organization. I remember one night that Portsmouth wireless station, one of our biggest ones, was put out of action for some time by bombing. Another night, when the central telegraph office, through which all our remote control lines passed, rang up to say that they were surrounded by fires and might have to evacuate at any moment. Fortunately, they didn't. But I don't think that, in general, my experiences of the Blitz itself differed from those of any other Londoner.
What do you remember about the spirit of Londoners during the Blitz?
Well, those we saw were terrific. Nothing seemed to get them down. The Admiralty functioned very well. We got damaged from time to time, but not too seriously. And on the one occasion in 1941, when we were badly blitzed, we were able to get up a large party of shipwrights and other men from Portsmouth Barracks, from Chatham Barracks, within a few hours, and make emergency repairs, much to the envy of the War Office, who apparently had suffered as much as we had, but didn't have anybody like they could call on like we did.
London must have looked quite a mess in those days.
Yes. Strangely enough, Whitehall, which one assumes to have been the bull of the target, was very little damaged. But, of course, Buckingham Palace, close by, was hit. Trafalgar Square was hit. Houses of Parliament were hit. The Guards Memorial in the near the Admiralty was hit, and so on.
What was hit in Trafalgar Square?
I think it was St. Martin's.
People say about the Blitz that we were all one then. Was that true?
Oh, very much. I saw it primarily from the Admiralty's point of view, but very few people stayed away at any time, and even if their homes had been blitzed, they still turned up for work in the morning. And there was a terrific spirit, there was no doubt about it.
But people say that class divisions were submerged.
Very much so, I would say. Certainly inside the Admiralty, I recall an evening when I was talking to my director, who was a Rear Admiral, in the corridor, and we heard a stick of bombs approaching, and we were both of us in a heap underneath the radiator.
Those were the days in just before the Blitz, in June 1940, when we always said that Britain and the Empire stood alone against the Germans. Did you feel that there was any question at that time that Britain might come to an accommodation with the Germans, with Hitler?
Personally, no. I did feel that the Germans might succeed in landing and that we might have a battle in the streets on our hands. And there were detailed arrangements for the Admiralty to be evacuated to the country. But there was no question in our minds of any surrender or accommodation. In fact, I'm quite certain that if the Germans had reached the outskirts of London, it would have been fought street by street, and the Germans would have had the most appalling casualties.
At that stage, when things looked so black, did you think the Germans could win?
That thought never crossed my mind. We thought that things might be very tough, that we might have to drop back from London, even possibly from England, but that we would still go on fighting.
Now, coming back to your signals work at the Admiralty, you mentioned the Pearl Harbor message. Are there any other outstanding messages or signals that you dealt with? For example, there was the occasion, I think, when there was the German invasion alert in the autumn of 1940.
Yes, I was in the Admiralty that night, and the duty signal officer called me down to the war room. This was before the days of the protected war headquarters of the Admiralty, and we had a temporary war headquarters down in the cellars. When I got into the war room, I saw the First Sea Lord, on the phone, and he was talking to the commander-in-chief of the Home Fleet up at Scapa. And I heard him say, "We think they're really coming out." A signal went out to the whole of the British Navy around England to raise steam, prepare to go to sea. The reasons for all this were threefold. A fog was reported coming up the channel, and the meteorologists said that it couldn't possibly be a proper fog. It must be artificial. There was a report of a very large force of ships off the east coast in a position where we did not have any forces of our own. And there was very heavy bombing indeed that night. The code word Cromwell went out from somewhere, and all forces came on full alert for a possible invasion. It did not last very long, because the meteorologists came back and said, after all, it might be a natural fog. The heavy conglomeration of ships off the east coast proved to be one of our convoys, hopelessly out of its proper position. And there was no particular explanation for the bombing. But it was an interesting experience, because for about an hour or so, we really thought the Germans had launched Ceylon.
Did you have anything to do with with work at the time of the fall of France?
Yes. We didn't take part in, or rather, the signal course I was teaching and myself took no part at Dunkirk. Other specialist courses were sent over to help on the beaches, but we were so near qualifying the course that, frankly, they were considered too valuable to be sacrificed. However, just after the course finished, I did go over to Havre to establish communications between our headquarters there and CNC Portsmouth. In fact, although I took a wireless set and some telegraphists with me, I discovered that the headquarters in Havre had a telephone line through to the War Office, which was apparently unknown except to the signalers manning it. I was able to establish direct communication with Portsmouth through this telephone line, and thereafter it was used for the day, which proved to be the last day at Havre, because we evacuated that night to Cherbourg. It was a pretty horrific scene in Havre, which was the main base for the British Expeditionary Force. They had vast coal stores and that sort of thing. The coal stores were all being opened and the meat allowed to rot. The transport was being immobilized and much of it pushed into the sea. However, I managed to get to Cherbourg quite safely and had the interesting experience of accompanying a captain, who was a senior naval officer, to visit Admiral Abrial, the commander of that French naval area, who was in a headquarters just outside Cherbourg. He maintained that the French would be able to hold the line of the Seine. And I was sent back to CNC Portsmouth to explain Admiral Abrial's plans and the sort of help and liaison he needed with Portsmouth. Very oddly, I travelled across the channel in the very last leave boat and managed to get to Portsmouth in the early hours of next morning, only to find that meanwhile orders had been given to evacuate the rest of France.
Did you have anything to do with communications with the beaches after the fall of France?
Yes. It was one of the odd jobs I picked up in my early days in the Admiralty. We had always realized that in combined operations, if the Navy landed forces in enemy territory, there would need to be some form of communication between the ships and the beaches. Our first experience was in the abortive attempt to take Dakar in the autumn of 1940. We learnt quite a lot from that. There were innumerable plans laid over the next 2 or 3 years, which did not take place, but involved considerable planning for beach signals. And we became woefully aware of the fact that we had not got the right sort of equipment for it, nor the training. We did press ahead. We learnt quite a lot from operations like the taking of Madagascar. And by the time that Normandy came along, we had a tremendous amount of communications equipment designed for use in the beach area. This varied from very light portable sets taken by signal men and telegraphists just astern of the first flight of troops, going up through bigger equipment and semi-mobile sets, up to really powerful transmitters which were built into containers which fitted on the backs of 3-ton lorries. This produced troubles of waterproofing and a lot of planning. For Normandy, we had a vast store of all this stuff near Portsmouth, which was treated literally like ammunition, and it was not expected that more than a very small percentage would ever return into stock. I was mixed up in the initial planning of Normandy, but of course a senior signal officer was appointed in fairly early stages, and thereafter I acted as an Admiralty liaison with him in getting all the stuff that he needed. I was fortunate enough to go over to a conference in the Normandy beachhead about